Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison. I'll be your host for the next 45 minutes or an hour or so. Never do quite know how long these are going to last, while we go through recent developments in the public safety workplace. I wanted to start off this month's podcast with a couple of news stories that have appeared in the last few days that I think both can be described by one word. And the first story can be described by the word duh, and the second story can be described by the word what? Okay, let's talk about duh first. This is an article that appeared in today's paper, first Thursday of November, today's paper, up in Alaska. And the headline is, Alaska State Troopers Find Fix for Hiring Woes, More Pay. Well, here's the situation up with the Alaska State Troopers. For years and years, they have had both a recruitment and a retention problem. The number of troopers has dropped precipitously over the years. It's already an extremely difficult job to be a trooper in Alaska, where on occasion your backup can be measured not by minutes or hours, but by days. And the low pay and low benefits in the Alaska State Troopers took their toll. I heard many, many times people associated with the troopers saying, if only we could be paid what Anchorage gets paid. And of course, they weren't even really close. Then in 2018, the former governor, an independent by the name of Bill Walker, announced a 15% raise over 2 years for troopers, 7.5% in 2018, another 7.5% in 2019, and there was a collective bargaining agreement that, in general, tried to put more money into the total compensation system. So what's the result? More than 1,000 people have applied in the last 3 months to join the Alaska State Troopers. More than have applied to join the troopers collectively in the last few years, since the record keeping actually began in 2017. What is everybody pointing to? The money. And this has always seemed so basic to me about the law enforcement recruitment and retention problem. And that is that people respond to what it is they're being paid. I know, like, duh, right? And if you have a job where you have very few applicants, where there is relatively less interest than you want, the first solution, I think, should be to look at your pay and benefit structure to see whether or not your compensation is adequate enough to compensate individuals who want to choose that career. That's the message they got up in Alaska, and it seems to be working. Now let's move to the what article. This is one that appeared the day before Halloween on October 30th, 2019. It appeared all over the Twin Cities and Minneapolis and St. Paul, all over the various news outlets there. Honestly, if this article had appeared on April 1, I would have suspected it was an April Fool's joke, but sadly, it's not. So what's the article about? The article is about an announcement made by the Hennepin County attorney through his chief deputy, a fellow named David Brown, and his media coordinator, a fellow named Chuck Lazuski. What's the announcement? If officers are involved in critical incidents, officers from anti-policing agency within Hennepin County, so not just the county, but various cities in Hennepin County, if they are involved in a critical incident, such as an officer-involved shooting, their personal cell phones will be seized and be subject to a search, their personal cell phones. Why? Lazuski says that this policy is part of a new investigative protocol that was released in the last few months. And he doesn't believe, get ready, this is coming from a county attorney. He doesn't believe the new policy is a violation of privacy rights, quote, because there are no privacy rights in a criminal investigation, end quote. What? Isn't that what the Fourth Amendment is all about? Is the creation of privacy rights in a criminal investigation? Isn't that what the guarantee that there will be no search and seizure but for the existence of probable cause and the obtaining of a warrant? Isn't that what it is all about? It's simply stunning that we can have this sort of public announcement from a county attorney. But you know what? It almost gets worse. Because those private cell phones don't have to have been in use at any time around the critical incident for the county attorney to want to seize and search them. That's pretty stunning as well. And the county attorney is simply taking the position that, and I'm going to quote again, if a police officer uses or has, that's my phrase, but that's what their policy says, their personal cell phone at the scene of an officer-involved shooting, they understand that phone could be part of the investigation. Really? Very not-so-audacious prediction here. We're going to see litigation over this soon and quickly. And you know what? I would hope that the plaintiff in that litigation is the Minnesota ACLU, because who should be more concerned with privacy rights than the ACLU? Now let's turn to the cases, and let's start with Florida. Well, I mean, Florida isn't exactly a case, but Florida does give rise to a disproportionate number of very interesting and unusual cases. This one is not all that unusual. This is an issue that comes up, I think, very routinely, once a year, twice a year, somewhere around the country. You'll see some litigation producing these results. And the question is a witness employee entitled to representation under the Weingarten Rule? You all know the Weingarten Rule. It comes from a U.S. Supreme Court decision that's now 50 years old. Under the Weingarten Rule, an employee who is subject to a disciplinary interview, an interview which the employee reasonably believes could result in discipline, is entitled upon request to representation by her or his labor organization. Weingarten itself was decided under the National Labor Relations Act, which doesn't apply to cities and counties and states, but the labor boards in really every state around the country that has a public sector collective bargaining law has found, those labor boards have found that something akin to Weingarten rights exist under their own labor statutes. So if you're in a collective bargaining environment, chances are, odds are extraordinarily good, there are Weingarten rights. And from time to time, we see arguments from employers that there is no right to representation if the employee is simply a witness and not a suspect in a disciplinary investigation. This recent Florida case involves a police officer by the name of Maylee Bardellis. Bardellis is an officer with the city of Doral, Florida. Her sergeant, a fellow named Eric Fernandez, accused her of intentionally driving away from an active shooter scene, and she was charged by the department with cowardice. Eventually, the investigation determined that there was insufficient evidence to generate a sustained finding that Bardellis was the officer who drove away from the incident, and the police chief directed the internal affairs investigator, a fellow named Glenn Stolzenberg, to reclassify Bardellis as a witness officer rather than a subject officer. And the chief also ordered that Stolzenberg designate the person who actually drove away from the incident as a, quote, unknown police officer, end quote. Stolzenberg orders Bardellis to come to IA for the taking of her statement as a witness officer. Bardellis requests a representative from her labor organization, something called the Professional Law Enforcement Association. Stolzenberg says no. He says, you're no longer the subject officer here. We're calling you as a witness. And he cites the department's regulations manual, which states that members providing witness statements are not entitled to a representative. Representing unions for as long as I have, I've got to say that I'm always grateful when an employer actually reduces its violation of the law to a provision in its regulations manual. It makes testimony so less necessary in the eventual case, whatever it might be. Well, so how does the interview go? Bardellis tells Stolzenberg that her representative is waiting downstairs. Stolzenberg says, no, your representative can't be here because you're a witness. Bardellis says, I'm not going to participate in the interview without representation. Stolzenberg says, if you don't participate, we're going to relieve you of duty starting right now. In the meantime, the representative tries to contact Stolzenberg and Bardellis by telephone. Stolzenberg says to Bardellis, don't answer your phone, and tells her, we're going to be conducting the interview. Bardellis, who's facing the threat of potential termination if she doesn't answer Stolzenberg's questions, participates in the interview, and eventually she's not disciplined for the underlying incident. The union, though, is not satisfied, and it files an unfair labor practice complaint with Florida's Public Employment Relations Commission. And really, could you have an easier case? Florida's PERC doesn't think so. And PERC starts with a sentence that, or actually a couple of sentences that I want to read you that are so important and have been said by labor boards all over the country as to whether or not witnesses have the right to union representation. Here are the sentences. The commission has consistently rejected the notion that an employee's right to union representation at a given meeting hinges on the label the employer attaches to the meeting. Thus, whether characterized as a conference, an interview, a meeting, an investigation, or interrogation, whether disciplinary or investigatory, the label does not determine an employee's Weingarten right. What does? Whether or not Bardellis reasonably believes that the interview could have resulted in discipline against her. And what would Bardellis reasonably believe under these facts? PERC says, well, Bardellis reasonably believes she was still considered to be the subject of the city's investigation into the allegation of cowardice. And that was a belief that any reasonable employee would have. Her belief is supported by the lack of any information from Stolzenberg, says PERC, or the city's management personnel, identifying any other subject officer. Stolzenberg threatened to relieve her of duty during the course of the interview. She had reason to believe that without regard to how the city classified her, she could be disciplined as a result of the interview. And that's a basic statement of the law. The employer's designation of the employee as a witness or a suspect is not the talisman upon which Weingarten rights turn. Rather, it's whether the employee, given all of the facts known to the employee, reasonably believes that they could be disciplined. And if the answer to that question is yes, they get a representative, even though they're designated as a witness. What if the employer goes ahead and tells the employee, look, we know you believe that you could be disciplined, but we promise. Here, we'll hand you something that is in writing that says you will not be disciplined no matter what answers you give to our questions. What happens in that event? Well, first of all, that event has never happened because I don't think an employer would ever give an employee a free pass like that. But there are some cases that come somewhat close. And the cases say this, and I'm thinking of a couple here. I'm thinking of one from Michigan, and second one is one from Washington from several years ago. The cases say this. They say, first of all, if an employer really does say, we promise you, you won't be disciplined, then there may not be a right to representation under Weingarten. But the employer is going to be held to that promise. And it will not be able to discipline that employee no matter what that employee says. And the second thing, or second case that I'm thinking about, the Washington case, started off with an employer that said, you're a witness, we're not going to discipline you. And then the employer, during the course of the investigatory interview, proceeded to cross-examine the employee to actually become a little bit threatening. And Washington's Public Employment Relations Commission said, look, they may have started off by saying you're not going to be disciplined, but everything they said and did after that would lead the employee to reasonably believe that they could be subject to discipline. Give them a representative. And I think kind of at the heart of that last decision is a feeling that lots of labor boards have, which is they look at an employer that is denying an employee a union representative, and they're saying, why are you doing that? Why not just allow the employee the representation? We'll avoid the fight over whether or not there is some sort of legal right to representation. And you know what? Having a knowledgeable representative in the room, and I'm hearkening back to words in the Weingarten decision itself here, having a knowledgeable representative in the room actually can help to the employer, and I'm quoting from Weingarten, get to the bottom of the incident that occasioned the interview to begin with. So, at any rate, not new law, but really a good reminder that I think everybody needs from time to time. Next up, a corrections case from the state of Missouri. But a little bit of background before I get into the corrections case itself. And we talk about how it is that a bunch of corrections officers won $113 million in a wage and hour lawsuit. So a number of years ago, 2014, the United States Supreme Court had the opportunity to decide a case that was called Integrity Staffing Solutions versus Busk. And we'll put a copy of that case online, a link to it, so that you can see the decision. And that was a case that involved a subcontractor for Amazon.com. And what they were doing was requiring employees to go through a security screening before they started work. These were employees who worked in an Amazon warehouse. And the Supreme Court ended up saying that the employees were not entitled to compensation for the time spent in the security screening. And the reason the court ruled that way was its conclusion that the employees were not actually being paid. Their job was not to go through a security screening. It was to do the warehouse work. And the security screening was not an integral part of their normal job responsibilities. It was a decision reached under an amendment to the Fair Labor Standards Act, a long ago amendment, in the late 1940s, I think, or maybe early 1950s, called the Portal to Portal Act that makes what the courts frequently call coming and going time non-compensable under the FLSA. Okay, so that's Integrity Staffing Solutions floating around out there for about 5 years and says if you go through a security screening under normal circumstances, not compensable as hours work. So what's going on in Missouri? Well, there's a collective bargaining agreement between the Missouri Department of Corrections and the Corrections Officers Association, and that contract has a clause in it that says that the Department of Corrections, the DOC, quote, will comply with the FLSA. And the DOC's policy manual also says that the provisions dealing with hours of work were intended, quote, to ensure departmental compliance with FLSA rules. A group of corrections officers brought a class action against the Department of Corrections. They were alleging a breach of contract for failure to pay for pre- and post-shift activities. What were the pre- and post-shift activities? How long did they take? They took 30 minutes a day, according to the corrections officers. Well, the pre- and post-shift activities, including things like electronically logging their arrival or departure from the facility by scanning barcodes, reporting to a central observation post to receive assignments, passing through security, including a metal detector on arrival, and through an airlock when entering and exiting the security envelope, presenting themselves to a custody supervisor who communicated to the officers their daily assignments, picking up equipment, walking to and from their duty posts from the security screening site, passing of pertinent information from one shift to another, and those who had cars doing an inventory of the cars issued weapons, ammunition, and equipment. A trial court eventually certifies a class of 13,000 current and former corrections officers. And remember, this whole thing is a breach of contract cause of action. It's not going into the federal courts. And so it ends up with a jury trial, and the jury returns a verdict of $113,714,632 against the state of Missouri. By the way, I stress the point that this is a breach of contract action and not in federal court. I haven't spoken to the lawyers who handled this case for the corrections officers, but I'm very, very suspicious of their motivation. And by suspicious, I don't mean to imply anything negative, because actually I think this was kind of a genius move. The federal courts have become much, much more conservative than the state court systems in our country. We had many, many federal court judges that were appointed by President George W. Bush, relatively few over an 8-year period appointed by President Obama. That was because the Senate, led by Mitch McConnell, you read about it in the papers, refused to confirm any number of judges and also just simply delayed confirming appointments. President Trump has been very successful at getting his judges appointed, and at really a record pace. And when you put that all together, we find that the significant majority of federal court judges today were appointed by Republican presidents. Why does that matter? Well, when I last updated my book on the Fair Labor Standards Act, I started thinking I was seeing a trend in the cases. And the way I do these books is I look over the time period that has passed since I last updated a book. In the case of the FLSA book, it had been a 5-year period of time. I collect all of the cases decided in that time period that are relevant to the book. So I was reading every federal court FLSA case that had been decided in the last 5-year period of time. And the trend that I started to see was that you could break down these FLSA cases into really a couple of categories. One category was cases where they were really no-brainers. When you read the facts, you knew who was going to win or lose because the case was really clear. And you almost ended up wondering, why is it this thing needs to be litigated? Why don't people just simply settle this case or simply not bring it to begin with? And then there are cases where the outcome was in doubt. It's that second set of cases that I ended up getting focused on, where the case could have gone either way, depending upon the findings of fact or less so the conclusions of law that a judge made. And what I found out was, once I ginned up Excel for a little bit, I found out that I could predict who was going to win those doubtful cases at about the 95% confidence level, simply by knowing the political party of the judge, or political party of the president, who had appointed the judge deciding the case. Now, that's wrong, right? That shouldn't be our American system of jurisprudence. But a 95% confidence level, that is not chance. That is ideology playing itself out in the form of court decisions. I don't think that's probably news to anybody at all. You see it on the national level all the time with the United States Supreme Court, much more so in the last 20, 30 years when the Supreme Court has become more partisan than it's ever been at any time in our history. Well, because the vast majority of federal court judges have now been appointed by Republican presidents, if I'm bringing a wage and hour case and there's any chance I can bring that case in state court rather than federal court, I'm in state court representing plaintiffs in these cases. If I'm an employer, I'm going to try to find some way, any way I can, to remove that case, transfer it into federal court. So when I saw this Missouri corrections case end up in state court, I sort of mentally thought about the plaintiff's lawyers in the case and thought, hey, nice job, people. Anyway, so the jury verdict, $113 million and change, if you can call $714,632 change, goes up to the Missouri Court of Appeals, where the state's argument is, first of all, Integrity Staffing Solutions, and secondly, the facts don't justify the verdict. And the court rejects those arguments and ends up concluding that the jury's verdict should be upheld. What's the court's reasoning? The court's reasoning is this is more than just going through a security screening operation. And these aren't warehouse workers. These are corrections officers. So let's take those two apart. First of all, this is more than security screening. It is, right? They're not only going through a metal detector, they're reporting to a supervisor, they're exchanging information with the people who are going off shift, they are loading information into cars, they're reporting to their workstations, et cetera, et cetera. Moreover, says the court, these are corrections officers. And I'm going to quote now. Officers are trained to be careful during pre- and post-shift activity and shift change time because they know those are the times that prisoners often take action, such as escape attempts and staging fights to divert officers' attentions. DOC has undisputed knowledge of and expectation for officers' requirement to use their training to guard against prisoner fights and escape attempts during shift changes. Therefore, the preliminary and post-preliminary, that's phrasing from the Portal to Portal Act, by the way, activities of the officers are not pre or post at all. Instead, these shift change activities are integral and indispensable to the officers' principal activities for which they are hired by DOC, that is, guarding against and protecting the public from prison riots and escape attempts. Those phrases that I just read you are pulled right out, many of them, pulled right out of the Portal to Portal Act and Integrity Staffing Solutions. So those of you who have been thinking out there, if you've got security screening and any work that is attendant to security screening, if you are thinking that Integrity Staffing Solutions provides the be-all and end-all answer to whether or not that time is compensable, think again. Next up, I want to head to a Massachusetts case involving a police officer. By the way, no firefighter cases this month, at least none that I think are significant enough that I should be talking about them on the podcast. Firefighters out there, you just need to get more litigious. Actually, I do have some cases lined up for next month, I think. So this Massachusetts case is a very odd one. I can count on the number of fingers on one hand how many times I have seen an ethics violation being charged against a public safety employee. And by ethics violation, many states have state ethics laws that apply to both state employees as well as local governmental employees. And they even have a commission or a board or something like that that decides ethics cases. And in the instance of Massachusetts, they have something called a state ethics commission that is all about enforcing ethics laws. They don't have disciplinary authority, but what they do have is the ability to fine an employee who engages in an ethics violation. And this case is out of Agawam, Massachusetts, and it involves a police lieutenant by the name of Edward McGovern. And all of this happens way back in 2012. So on the evening of June 29th, 2012, about 9 o'clock at night, the West Springfield Police Department, now that's not McGovern's agency, remember he's with Agawam, so the West Springfield Police Department receives an anonymous 911 call reporting a wrong-way driver on a local road. Three responding officers from West Springfield find an Agawam police officer, Danielle Petrangelo, sitting on the guardrail next to the passenger side of an SUV crying. The officers see damage on the side of the SUV that's consistent with it striking a guardrail. And one of the officers, who's a friend of Petrangelo, these are cities are very close to each other, knew that she had been placed on administrative leave from her department pending an IA investigation into an incident in which she shot an unarmed woman in the face at the scene of a domestic dispute. Lieutenant McGovern arrives at the scene shortly after the three responding officers. He talks to Petrangelo. He believed that she was intoxicated. He then talks to the three officers. He asked, "Do you have any charges in my city?" And he's told there were none, i.e. no charges that occurred in Agawam itself. McGovern asks, "Were there any witnesses?" The officers say no. McGovern says, "Do any of you have operation?" In other words, did any of the officers have evidence that Petrangelo had been driving the SUV? And the three officers said no. McGovern doesn't ask him much more. He doesn't ask him where the SUV was found at the scene, whether Petrangelo made any statements or admissions, and he didn't order any of his subordinate officers to make a report of the incident. Instead, what he did was to order his own department, Agawam, to drive Petrangelo to her residence. He didn't order the officers to arrest or cite her for drunk driving or even reckless driving, or as it's called in Massachusetts, driving to endanger. He did speak with the police chief about the incident at the start of his next workday, and the chief said, "I'm going to open an IA investigation and don't take any further action." However, the matter ends up before the Massachusetts Ethics Commission, and the commission finds that McGovern used his official position to decide not to arrest or to cite Petrangelo when there was probable cause to do so. What is the commission's action that it takes? It imposes a civil fine of $7,500. McGovern then appeals, and it goes to the Massachusetts Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals upholds the fine. Here's a few sentences from the court's opinion. It is indisputable that McGovern did not make any searching inquiry of the investigating officers. He didn't inquire where the SUV was found on arrival at the scene. He didn't ask how it came to be parked to the side of the highway or whether Petrangelo made statements or admissions. He instead made an unguarded remark to a sergeant that we can't arrest her. And when you put it all together, says the court, these facts constitute substantial evidence that McGovern had probable cause to arrest or cite Petrangelo, and that by declining to do so, despite a written policy in the department that prioritized arresting people suspected of drunk driving, McGovern ended up providing an unwarranted privilege or exemption to Petrangelo not available to other motorists in like circumstances, hence ethics violation. Interesting case, like I say, you just don't see these things. I can't remember one in the last 5 years, although I have this sneaking suspicion we're probably going to see more of them. Also an interesting question, and I can't find the answer to this anywhere in when I've looked into it. Who's going to pay that $7,500 fine? I suspect it may be Lieutenant McGovern. I suspect that the city may be prohibited from paying that fine. Interesting case. Next up, I want to talk about a New York case, and this is from an appeals court in New York. It's called the Appellate Division in New York, and it's a very odd case that produces an odd result and makes me wonder whether or not it's going to be upheld on appeal. So what's going on in this case? It's an NYPD case, and the Internal Affairs Bureau in NYPD apparently conducts integrity tests from time to time, or perhaps on an ongoing basis. The court's opinion doesn't indicate which. And in this integrity test, an undercover officer who worked for Internal Affairs acted intoxicated while illegally parked next to a fire hydrant. There's a video taken of the incident, and it showed Officer Richard Arroyo going into the vehicle, taking $55 from the center console, taking a $20 bill from that $55, putting it in his left hand, and then counting out the remaining $35 and grabbing that with his right hand. And outside, when he is counting the money in the presence of the theoretically intoxicated, but really undercover officer, he counts out $35, not $55. During an IA interview, Arroyo lies about it. He maintained that he didn't count the money inside the vehicle, and that he gave all the money he recovered back to the, quote, owner, end quote, of the vehicle, and he did not take the money that did not belong to him. Later on, he admitted to the theft, but he denied lying about the theft. I'm not sure how that works, but that's the way the facts are stated by the court. And the department fires him. It goes through an internal hearing board that exists in NYPD, and it finds its way to the appellate division, the appeals court that I was talking about. Now, a little bit of background before we get into the appellate division's decision. In New York, in NYPD, you have kind of an odd structure for the appeal of discipline. Discipline isn't appealed through the collective bargaining agreement involving the Police Benevolent Association and NYPD and City of New York. In fact, if you were to take a look at the collective bargaining agreement, the PBA's collective bargaining agreement, I can pretty much guarantee you'd be shocked by how brief it is. It's one of the smallest collective bargaining agreements I've ever seen, much less for a large city. There are whole swaths of things that are normally in collective bargaining agreements that just aren't in the PBA's collective bargaining agreement with the city of New York. And one of them is an appeal structure for a discipline. You don't see binding arbitration of discipline. Instead, discipline, once it's imposed, discipline ends up getting appealed into the court system. And when you get into the court system, you have what's called a standard of review. What deference is a court going to give to the administrative decision that was made before the case came into the court system? And the deference that New York courts have given, particularly on the issue of the appropriateness of a disciplinary penalty, is that they will uphold whatever it is NYPD does so long as it doesn't, and I'm quoting, shock the conscience of the court. And the appeals court here finds that termination of Arroyo for theft and dishonesty shocked the conscience of the court. Why? Okay, I'm going to quote. Arroyo's conduct, although troubling, was an aberration from his otherwise exemplary career. He has nearly two decades of police service, prior to which he served in the United States Army for 8 years, where he was a sergeant in the military police, receiving an honorable discharge. The court goes on to talk about the fact he had no prior disciplinary history. He had received 38 medals over the course of his career. And here's the big one, and I'm going to quote. Moreover, the loss of Arroyo's pension, and that's what would happen if you're discharged under these circumstances, the loss of Arroyo's pension would work a financial hardship on his wife, who is diagnosed with cancer, and their now 10-year-old daughter. And the court ends up saying that the deprivation of retirement benefits in this case is, and I'm quoting, an affront to our sense of fairness and shocks the conscience. Now, there's a dissenting judge who talks about everything you might imagine a judge dissenting from this opinion would talk about. The fact that police officers hold a position of public trust and have to be held to the highest standards of honesty and integrity. And really, I'm thinking we may not have seen the last opinion in this case, that this case may end up going to the highest court in New York, a court that is kind of oddly named the Court of Appeals, the mid-level courts, the appellate division there. I think this one may end up higher. Okay, last case I want to talk about, it actually isn't a case, it's another news article that I saw, and I have to tell a war story on myself about this case, because this case reminded me of the time that I lost litigation. I lost what would have been a $23 million judgment to a building. Well, first of all, what's the news article? And secondly, how do you lose a case to a building? Okay, well, the news article is that the Nevada Highway Patrol Association is taking advantage of a recent change in Nevada state law that allows state employees to unionize for decades. City and county employees in Nevada have had the right to form labor organizations and to bargain. The collective bargaining statute calls for binding arbitration, but state employees have not been allowed to unionize. That didn't happen until the last session of the legislature. And the Nevada Highway Patrol Association has just filed a petition for representation, looking to represent Highway Patrol troopers, parole and probation officers, game wardens, Capitol Police, and a few others. What's the motivation for it? I'm going to quote from the president of the Nevada Highway Patrol Association, a drastic pay disparity. All right. So why does that remind me of a case that I lost to a building? Well, once upon a time, I want to say this is about 25 years ago or so, my law firm, I had a much larger law firm then, started representing the Nevada Highway Patrol Association. And by the way, nothing I'm about to say here is confidential at all, of course. And when I first went down to meet with the association, of course, I read the state laws, and I was kind of shocked to find that state employees didn't have the right to form a labor organization. Only city and county employees did. And I heard the same complaints back, let's say it's 25 years ago, that you saw in the statement from the association's president when he announces their desire to unionize. Their pay wasn't what it should be. So I rooted around a little bit in the Nevada statutes, and I found something called a prevailing wage law. And this law obliged the Nevada legislature, the state of Nevada, to pay its employees a prevailing wage. And what's a prevailing wage? It's the wage that is paid to other employees performing like work in the area. The wording of the law was that the state shall compensate employees at the prevailing wage. So I got the idea, you know, we've got this wonderful study from the Nevada Personnel Department, Department of Personnel, I think it was called, that shows that Nevada Highway Patrol troopers are way behind the prevailing wage, and why not file a lawsuit to seek to enforce the prevailing wage law? And indeed we did. It went to a trial court judge in Reno, and we won. And it was like a monstrous wage increase. I forget the exact percent. I think it was about 28% wage increase, and it ended up compounding into $23 million. And the state, of course, appeals it. So I go down for the oral argument in the case before the Supreme Court of Nevada, and it's a grand old building, you know, one of these buildings, courthouses that you see out west with some regularity that was built, seems like it was built 100 years ago, built out of something that kind of sort of looks like concrete, but not quite. And I have an oral argument. I think it goes really good because, you know what, the word shall means shall. And then the court sits on the case, and it sits on it for an uncomfortable period of time. And then I start to hear rumors from down in Nevada. And what are the rumors? The rumors are that the state of Nevada has traded our case for a building. What's the building? The Nevada Supreme Court isn't happy with that grand old building, the one that I liked, and great courtroom, by the way. It wanted a new spanking new building. And that a deal had been cut between the powers that be in the legislature and the Nevada Supreme Court that we would lose our case and the Supreme Court would get their building. And of course, when I heard that, I thought, you know, people are hearing footsteps behind them. That sort of thing doesn't happen. You know, it might happen in another country, or, you know, it might have happened somewhere in this country 100 years ago, but that sort of thing doesn't happen. And then the decision came down. And what happened? We lost. The Nevada Supreme Court held that shall meant may. And what happened immediately after that? You know where this story is going. The legislature appropriated the money for a spanking new Supreme Court building for the Supreme Court. The legislature also, by the way, in the following session of the legislature, actually implemented a wage increase that over time got the troopers up to their prevailing wage. So we ended up actually kind of sort of prevailing in the case. But for the rest of my professional career, I think of myself as having the singular decision of perhaps, can't say this for sure, right? Perhaps having lost a case to a building. Quite an accomplishment, right? Well, that's it for this month. I want to commend you to listen to our premium podcast series if you haven't signed up for that yet. I've done a couple of interviews in the last week that we're going to roll out over the course of the next month or two, and I really enjoyed doing these interviews. The first was with a couple of partners, principals, in the large management side firm that's known as Ogletree Deacons. This is a firm that has almost 1,000 lawyers around the country. And we talked about the legality of physical agility tests in the public safety world. And there's going to be some surprises there for you in that podcast. The second podcast I did was with two partners in the California law firm of Raines, Lucia, and Stern. I talked with Mike Raines and Rocky Lucia, and this was a longish podcast. We talked all things body cams in this podcast, and that podcast went on for, well, I want to say an hour and a quarter, hour and a half, and Rocky and Mike were just great. And it was just a tremendous dialogue talking about a variety of policy issues that come out of the body cam world. And I think it was punctuated by actually an interesting debate where Rocky and Mike took one side of an argument and I took the other side. I don't normally grill our podcast guests, but these are old friends and they can take it. So with that, thank you for joining us on First Thursday. And I want to remind everybody that we have our first wellness seminar that we've ever constructed. It's a huge seminar we're putting on in March of 2020 in Nashville. We have speakers from all over the country talking about the various aspects of physical and psychological wellness for public safety employees. People are already registering for this, even though we're 5 months away from it. I think it's going to be, for me, it's going to be a really exciting topic to address for the first time in our seminars. So with that, hope you're not too freezing cold wherever you are. I just came from Anchorage where it's in the 30s already. This is Will Aitchison signing off.